Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hi, fam.
Hey.
Today, we're diving into a fascinating time of learning and conversation about the evidence-based practice of ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy. And joining us is none other than Dr. Michael Tuig, a leading researcher and clinician in the field. So get comfy, because we are both accepting and inviting some really interesting conversation ahead.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, fam. Alrighty, how are we doing? Little vibe check to start off. We had Valentine's last week and a great episode with Mike Hetty. This week we have another Mike, Dr. Mike Tuig, and he is super prominent in the growing research around ACT, which again stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And so I'm really glad that you're here. I'm here. I am practicing and living to my values today, because I'm going to just be honest here, fam. It's been a rough week here for our family. And as we'll talk about a little bit later, what does it mean to live to your values, even when something's hard or uncomfortable or painful? It's doing the thing. And so that is a very real practice for me this week, and I am so excited to be able to share this conversation with you. And Mike is so incredibly woven into the nucleus of ACT's research, along with Dr. Stephen Hayes, with Doug Woods, who does a lot of work in the OCRD realm, which are OC-related disorders, Jack Rackman, who is like the OG OCD researcher, and you can tell something about someone by the company he keeps. And I tell you, Mike is very deserving right there in the thick of all the amazing research that he is doing to help bring greater understanding, greater hope, greater technologies, as we'll discuss later, to ACT. But I have to say, when I started learning exposure and response prevention, or what we refer to here in the field as ERP, I couldn't separate out the idea of ACT. And so for a long time, I think it's taken some dedication and focus to understand what is ACT, how does it function, even as a singular treatment without ERP or without something like inference-based CBT or iCBT or metacognitive therapy. What can it bring to the table? And so I'm really excited to have Mike here today, and I want to just jump right into the conversation because it's so, so good. So let me just brag on Mike for a second, and then I promise you, fam, we'll get right to it. So Mike is a licensed psychologist and professor of psychology at Utah State University here in the States, where he co-runs the ACT Research Group. With a PhD from the University of Nevada and extensive training in ACT, he has dedicated his career to advancing its use for OCD and related disorders. He's authored over 200 peer-reviewed papers and multiple books, including The Anxious Perfectionist, which is already in my Amazon cart. As I've told Mike, I am a recovering perfectionist. It sounds like it's right up my alley. And he's also written Trichotillomania, an ACT Enhanced Behavior Therapy Approach. His research has been funded by organizations like the National Institute of Mental Health and the International OCD Foundation, and he's been recognized as one of the most prolific ACT researchers in the world. So fam, what an honor that he is here to hang out with us. I super appreciate that. He's super down to earth, and I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, family, let's dive in. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And today I am thrilled because I've had a lot of mics on the show lately, but I have been, in pursuit of having a deeper conversation about a very important evidence-based practice called acceptance and commitment therapy. You may have heard it referred to as ACT here in the OCD field. We have lots of acronyms. But I have Mike Tuig with me today, who is really, I was just saying to him before we started recording, family, that he has just really helped spearhead and lead continued research for ACT. And so thank you so much for coming and hanging out with the fam today, Mike.
Well, Nicole, thank you very much for having me here.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And so we're going to get into ACT and we're going to talk about the different facets of it. And I'm really excited because this is an evidence-based treatment option for our OCD warriors. And a lot of times you'll hear it described, infused with exposure and response prevention or ERP or other treatment models even. But first of all, before we, talk about infusing it, it's really good to understand what are we infusing with ERP? What is it? And can it stand alone? Yes, actually, it can absolutely stand alone. So we're going to get into all the fascinating facets of ACT. But first, I have a lot of different practitioners and researchers come on the show, and I'm always fascinated about how people have gotten into treating OCD in the first place or into researching OCD. And so I would love, if you're open to it, Mike, to hear how you got into this specialty.
Yes. And I will try to make this on the quicker side, but boy, it could be a long story. The quicker version is I'm doing my master's in Milwaukee with a guy named Doug Woods. And if you kind of follow the trichotillomania Tourette syndrome, you follow that work, Doug's kind of the big name. So we were doing habit reversal stuff for trichotillomania and Tourette syndrome. And this is like 1999. And I said to Doug, I said, we're telling these clients what they ought to be doing, and they're having a hard time doing it. Like they're feeling stressed, they're feeling overwhelmed, they're not feeling motivated. And he said, you should learn how to do ACT. And the interesting thing is, I always like Steve Hayes, who's the person who's most credited with starting ACT. I always like Steve's writings on behavior analysis. Mm-hmm. So I'd always followed him as sort of a philosopher. Mm-hmm. So long story short, in 1999, we fly out to Reno, spend a weekend getting trained by Steve. And then I did a study that was habit reversal plus ACT for trichotillomania. And I remember Doug going, you don't know how good of an idea this is. Right. So 25 years later, I think he was right. Like ACT has become a pretty big thing in the OCD world.
Yeah.
So did that study, worked out pretty well. Then went, because I had done some work on ACT, I went and got my PhD with Steve Hayes, and I did a master's and a dissertation there on ACT for OCD. And in my mind, at that time I was like, well, I did hair pulling. OCD kind of seems like the next step. And I did those two projects and fell in love with working with these participants. And people say, well, why do you like OCD? I love it because first I love the creative problem and that there's a solution. I love that there's such complicated cognitions, like they're super fun to work with. And my participants really want help and want to get better. And it's just so rewarding.
Yeah.
So I spent some time with Maureen Whittle and Jack Rackman up at UBC and learned how to do cognitive therapy. And then came down to Utah and have been running a lab ever since, totally focused on ACT, but we've really spread it out into the whole OCD and related area and anxiety and probably broader. So I've been here about 20 years, but OCD and trich are kind of like my core place I keep coming back to, but we do a lot of work in other, skin picking, misophonia.
Yeah.
Boo, can't stop viewing porn, like all those areas.
And I think I saw hoarding too. Started kind of trickling into the hoarding area, or has it been there for a while?
Well, I'm kind of old enough that hoarding was in OCD. So then those first trials had hoarding in them.
Right.
And then it got pulled out. And then we've had two students who were really focused on hoarding. Kind of a weird story. Randy Frost, the big hoarding researcher.
Yes.
I think I've had four of his students in my lab. So four. I have one right now even. So they've kind of brought the hoarding focus into our lab.
Wow. I've emailed a little bit back and forth with Randy Frost, and we've toyed with the idea of him coming. He's certainly busy, but I love that. And people listening, We certainly here, we talk about OCRDs, OC-related disorders, because we want to provide support to family members, loved ones, and people with lived experience across the board. People here might be surprised to learn, I know I was, we were talking a little bit again before we started recording, that ACT can be absolutely utilized for body-focused repetitive behaviors, otherwise known as BFRBs. Again, family, I'm sorry, it's alphabet soup over here in the treatment world.
Right.
Lots and lots of acronyms. But it is interesting because trichotillomania, or hair pulling, and Tourette's, which is a tic disorder, people may not realize that ACT had more of an origin prior to OCD, treating these other related conditions. And so I think all the more reason for us to be able to learn and really understand ACT better, because it's not just something that can get infused with another treatment model for OCD. It is its own thing, and it's transdiagnostic. It's not just for OCD. And so I'm excited to learn more about that today. I didn't know you worked with Jack Rackman. I mean, that's very impressive, the crew you've worked with.
I got to do co-therapy with Jack Rackman. I remember one day he's like, Mike, I'm feeling tired. You're in charge today. And I was like, here I'm an ACT therapist supposed to do cognitive therapy with him. He was the sweetest. He was one of the sweetest people on the earth. He was a great person.
Yeah, I love that. And so if you can tell, family, we are talking then with a giant ourselves here with Mike Tuig, because he is very well plugged in and in the thick of all of this. And so thank you so much for taking the time. And so we're going to start with, what is ACT? And I know it's broad and there's a lot to it, but if you were sitting there and trying to explain, here's an option for treatment, what more or less would you say is your elevator pitch? And then we can digest it even more and zoom in, because I know there's going to be so many questions and wonderful conversations we can have. But can you, first of all, just kind of describe more broadly, what is ACT?
Yep. So ACT is a form of cognitive behavior therapy. So if you think of CBT as sort of like a general umbrella, and there's many different versions of it. So like metacognitive therapy and dialectical behavior therapy, and I'd probably argue exposure and response prevention, and ACT, we're all just different versions of this larger umbrella that we call cognitive behavior therapies, meaning it's empirically based, it targets particular problems, and we try to help those people in a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So at the core of ACT is that thinking and emotions are events that happen for people that we don't get to choose whether they happen, when they happen, how big they happen. And sometimes they make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they don't make any sense at all. And people can learn how to notice that we're having emotions and that we're thinking. And then you have an option of whether you buy into that thought or emotion. And this is just a skill. And once you get better at that skill, then it doesn't matter what thought or emotion you're having, that your choices of what you're going to do in that moment are much less decided by your thoughts and emotions, and much more decided by this thing we call values, which is the thing that you care about, that you want to do in that moment. So if I give a quick like OCD example, that even like a difficult one, like a fear of harming a child or something, even though that shows up as disgusting and horrific and carries a lot of emotion, with a lot of practice, you can realize this is just my mind spitting out weird pictures, weird words, and my body has the natural feelings that would go along with those horrific pictures. And I can catch that that's not a real process and I don't have to buy into it. And then you get much better at just like not engaging with that, and it becomes your new pattern.
Yeah. So you notice there's an element of pattern recognition then, where you're able to spot it and it becomes less threatening because you're aware this is just an intrusive thought is, you know, verbiage we would use in the ERP world. But this is, it's a thought. It's a thought.
Right.
And so it's really a skill set for being able to sift through and notice and disregard the blah.
Yeah. It's like if your mind is going to throw out thoughts all day long, I mean, thousands of them.
Right.
And let's say hundreds have utility, and that means thousands don't. We ignore thoughts all day long.
Right.
And it's just like there's certain ones that are very hard to ignore, but you can get good at just like noticing them and letting them go.
Yeah, I think I read, and it's been a hot minute since I've looked, so it may have been updated, but I was reading a research article where it was talking about, you know, you may on average have something somewhere between 6,500, 7,500 thoughts a day. Mm-hmm. They're not all winners. And my joke is like, it's kind of like sushi at Trader Joe's. They're not all winners, right? Like some stuff you're just like, that's not where to go for this thing, right? And so being able to notice, because it's getting a lot of people's attention, particularly when it comes to OCD. But, you know, one thing that I'm curious about, because I'm even thinking about it for like our body focus, repetitive behavior friends here. Would you classify that can work for the noticing of urges? Because sometimes it can be that feeling of urge.
Yeah.
And then we can attach that thought with it, right? But also, would you classify that act as really kind of helping you be able to sift out any of that really input that you're getting?
Yes. And I think there's two kind of cool parts. Like if we just use trichotillomania, the hair pulling, mm-hmm. you know, so someone may see like a thick hair that probably is going to be like a real winner. And they'll talk about if they don't pull that out in the morning, that the thought of that hair will just like stick with them all day long.
Yeah.
Right. And imagine if you had the skill to just like high thought, notice it, and then you'd get better at not having to buy into that one. And then the second part is we're not always letting go of disturbing thoughts. Sometimes we're like not buying into thoughts that pull us towards enjoyable things. So like overeating or drinking or dangerous sexual behavior or pulling that one hair out. Because people who pull, they enjoy the feeling of it.
Yeah.
And so you have to let that go too. And from this model, it's more like, well, which thoughts do I want to listen to? It's not the good or bad thoughts. It's right now, what is the thought that's most useful?
Yeah.
Like if I gave an example, if I'm doing a podcast with someone, well, it's probably my job to ignore 99% of other things happening, mm-hmm. right? So if one of my kids texts me right now, well, I still love them as much as ever, but it's probably not the time to look at it.
Right.
Right. So I can just like notice that I have that urge and not follow that. And I can like buy into that at the time that it's useful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so noticing, I think, is, you know, a huge piece that you're highlighting. Because if we, and I tend to think in analogy. So I like that example with the text. I'm going to zoom in a little bit on that. Sometimes, folks, we can come up with solutions. And particularly in OCD, there is this urge to solve. Right? That solving compulsion. So we can come up with a solution like put do not disturb on and then mm-hmm. revisit it. And that can kind of help block our attention from getting redirected there. But really, in ACT, from my understanding at least, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it would be not needing to rely on do not disturb. But it would be like, I can notice it come in and also be like, not at this time, not dealing with it. Because in the example of the text, I'm probably going to revisit it at some point. But even, you know, when it comes to OCD or a lot of the intrusive content, we don't even need to revisit it. And being able to go, there isn't utility in me revisiting that. I don't have to go back to it at all. Sometimes I might get stuck kind of going back mm-hmm. to it, but I don't have to go back to it. So I'm glad then it sounds like I'm understanding that correctly, because it's not to say like a tool that functions like do not disturb can't be helpful, particularly in the texting example. But also, if we're relying only on that tool, then what do we do when we're bombarded with different thoughts that we feel like without this thing here, I'm not going to be able to ignore it?
I'll say, if you know ACT well, you'd say we are not about emotional control. So like emotions are going to come and go, and I'd want my clients to have the ability to be the kind of person they want to be regardless of what emotions they have. And, okay, I'm a behaviorist, so it's going to come out a little funny. Like we have free will, like we can make choices. So you can do things to set up your life in a way that's going to be more the way you want. So like, here's one of my examples. Days that I have clinical work, mm-hmm. I've learned I shouldn't exercise in the morning, because if I get up at 6, then exercise, then by 4 o'clock, if I have a client, I am not as ready. So I can do things to feel more awake. Like I can go to bed early and I can like not set my alarm really early and then I'll have more energy. Like when I said the thing about the text, I like went to my computer and shut that off and turned my phone upside down, but it still could buzz. Mm-hmm. I could still just out of nowhere have a thought like, oh, I wonder if everything's okay at home. So yes, do things if it makes your life better, but I would not 100% rely on them because I can't structure my whole world to not have disturbing thoughts come in. Right. I can do everything I want and I'm still going to have little things sneak in. So that's kind of the act take, like when they show up, you have an ability to not listen to them if that's what you want.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is how anybody might phrase it, but I was thinking about another conversation I was having with someone recently. And it's interesting because we can so often feel victim to the circumstances, victim to the thought.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like about what you're saying is it feels more like an empowerment. It's not that I'm a victim to the thought. We all have our good amount of garbage thoughts, our good amount of good thoughts, or
right.
plenty of neutral thoughts, you know, in there as well. But really feeling empowered that you have some choice around how you respond or
yeah.
don't respond to it. And so I think, and in most things in life, when we can move forward with empowerment, I think that's going to not only build our confidence, but it's going to feel much more value-driven to be able to be like, I got this. I can handle this.
That's right.
Right. You know, versus feeling like, blah. And that's the way that people's worlds get very, very small, because ultimately,
right.
no matter how you could, your life could get confined down to a small room and it's still going to be a thing that we have brains and brains brain.
Right.
And so we're going to have thoughts. And so I really like that framing of it. All right, Bam. If you're getting value out of our conversation, but you haven't hit subscribe or followed OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts and YouTube, please take a moment, no time like the present, to hit that button. It's free, it's easy, and it ensures that not only will you never miss an episode, but that more folks can find the OCD Family community. Because fam, we know we're better together. Now, back to today's chat. And so in terms of noticing and how to kind of help manage that process, would love to mm-hmm. talk more with you about some of the skills and some of what you found through research that is really helpful in managing that process when we're leaning into a model like ACT or not
yeah.
ACT.
Yeah.
I'm judging myself for saying that because ACT, that's how I say it.
Well, and I'll just quick, if anyone's like, why ACT, not ACT, it's because there was already an ACT out there. So we had a,
gotcha.
There was assertiveness communication training. So we had to go the other way because,
gotcha.
You know, it's one of those things you pick the name and then a year goes by and you're like, oh, shoot, someone claimed that already.
Right.
I guess the T with therapy, there's going to be lots of things that end in T. So you were talking about like confidence and empowerment. So here's like a first underarching base thing for ACT is that if you wanted your cognitions to shift, mm-hmm. we would believe, and this is kind of because we're behaviorists, the best way to shift a cognition is change your behavior. So if you want confidence and empowerment, I think it's not going to be so much that I'm going to convince you you're good at something. I'm going to like talk you up.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, I want you to go do it 100 times. And when you have success a lot of the time, then you will start to
learn.
You know, you'll start to build that up. And
yeah.
I was just thinking, like, you know, I had this podcast with you and I knew it was on my schedule. I don't know how many listeners would be like, I would feel the feeling of anxiety before being on a podcast. This felt like a normal work day to me.
Yeah. Right?
Like I just came in between you and I was here 5 minutes before this started. I like started my computer, got water. And where's that come from? Well, that's from 20 years of being a professor.
Yeah.
That like, I didn't think like, Mike, you can talk about this. It's just, I talk about ACT every day. So like just somewhere in me is like, this is a skill you have.
Yeah.
So people are like, if they're thinking, how do I get there? Well, you get there by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then the next part is, yeah, but it's really hard to do it. And I think that's where ACT, these acceptance and diffusion and noticing, connecting with your values, that's where it can reduce the amount of like internal struggle you have and make it easier to start engaging in these new behaviors and then sort of build that confidence.
Yeah, I like that example. And I will vouch that as a podcast host, I meet with people regularly that honor us with sharing their stories and their insight and their experience. And a lot of people are very, very nervous. And I will say, even mm-hmm. when I started in the beginning, I was nervous. I was telling Mike I'm a recovering perfectionist and I was nervous about doing it right, even though I try to kind of live a good enough, just just get out there and do it. But now at this point, to me as well, it's like, I mean, it's definitely a day for work for me. I was just like, hey, I'm doing an interview today.
Right, right.
So yes, that repeated practice absolutely does help. That exposure, that getting out there in life and living it absolutely helps. It is interesting because as I've learned more about ICBT too, though, I have learned that a lot of what ICBT promotes is really looking at the reasoning process and how we came to a faulty reasoning process. And so our behavior is never going to get to the point of feeling, in this example, nervous, although that is a pretty common fear. But when it comes to OCD, we're never going to get to this compulsive response if we can kind of fix the faulty reasoning and how it was applied. And so it is interesting because I feel like, you know, if we think of CBT as that triangle, we shift any part of that, that's going to make a difference in the rest of the triangle. But yeah, and you were speaking to the cognitive diffusion. And I would just say for maybe even new listeners or new people that are just fresh into their loved one having a diagnosis, et cetera, I know many of us practitioners know what it is, but can you explain what you mean by cognitive diffusion?
Yeah. And I'll try to tell in a story that will maybe be useful for people. So the very first ACT study, and people may not know this, was actually, okay, the very first ACT study. I'm sure that's not like the very first, but the first like randomized trial of ACT was actually run at Aaron Beck's lab, not at UNR with Steve Hayes. It was one of Steve Hayes' postdocs was working with Aaron Beck. And in cognitive restructuring, you notice your thought, right? You like put it out in front of you and then you challenge it. So like, you know, he would do depression. So like, I'm a horrible person. Nobody likes me. And you'd hold out there and then you'd like find lot reason for that. And does that make sense? And do you actually have friends? And like, if you called 10 people, how many would actually hang out with you? And diffusion was, instead of doing the challenging, you just put the thought out in front of you.
Yeah.
Right. And notice it as a thought. Like, can you notice that these are just words that are occurring in your head? And then obviously, like, we built out the technology over the last 45 years. So now it adds, you know, noticing the thought and recognizing it for what it is, right? These are just words in your head that are prompted by some stimulus in front of you. Mm-hmm. So like, I might be sitting here and my stomach creates a feeling. And then I have the thought, oh, when's the next time you can eat? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like I look outside and it's kind of gloomy. And then I think, not a very good day to go do activities outside. It's just a response to some stimuli. So if you have OCD, you know, you're just walking and you see a little something, you have a little feeling and it triggers a thought. So recognizing that that thought are just words that popped in your head because some stimulus was out there. Mm-hmm. Like if I say the following word and, you know, I bet most of you are going to have a thought, like if I say pineapple, there was nothing big or important or meaningful about pineapple, right? Literally, I said it because we had some pineapple with our breakfast. So that was probably on my mind. I said the word, you had the thought, that's it. There's nothing profound, magical, important. And I'd argue, what if all thoughts are that? Like, they're just things that pop into our head, and then we have a choice to listen to them or not. So that's diffusion.
Yeah. So if we think about, and you tell me if I muddy this up too much with using a similar but different word, almost an infused interpretation or meaning of something, that we can attach these kind of different ideas of what that means. Right. And so pineapple is going to represent a food. It also might represent a signal. It might represent a favorite thing, a favorite fruit or whatever the thing is.
Right. Right.
And so that's not going to be the same across the board for everyone else. But it doesn't mean that we can't operationalize that differently. Doesn't mean that that absolutely is what that means. And the fear, I think a lot of times within OCD or the revulsion, depending on how that's manifesting, is, oh my gosh, I had this thought. It means this. Mm-hmm. And that means I'm terrible or I could cause harm or, you know, fill in the blank. The mind is incredibly creative. So there are endless possibilities. And so part of it is realizing that you're right. Like pineapple, you can say pineapple and it can mean the fruit you had for breakfast. It can mean something that's on sale this week. It can mean tiki bar. It can mean lots
that's
of things, right? And so being able to start to distill that down and go, yeah, it can mean these different things, but it's also just a word. It's just a thought.
Right.
Right.
Right. And one of the things that happens is you know, when you build out a thought, okay, so like if I said, if I'm going to keep going to like child harm because I live in a religious community and the worst thing you could do here is harm your child. So that's kind of the type of OCD we get a lot here. You know, so if I say the word child, to a handful of people, they like felt a little sad because they cared for their loved one. Other people felt anxious because that's their obsession. And, you know, maybe other people who that's nothing to them are like, oh, I miss my kid or I love my kid or, you know, whatever the thing is. The emotion that gets brought on by a cognition that we have, it does this funny thing where it gets people to think this is really important. Mm-hmm. Like when you feel the feeling of anxiety along with the thought child, it's like, oh, that must be a really big one. And the truth is, the emotion that goes along with our thought, it's nothing. It's just, mm-hmm. it's just our old conditioning. Like it feels like it means something, but I'd argue it doesn't. It's just in our life with repetition, that thought was paired with this thing. So now when we have that thought, it brings that emotion along. Like there's a reason that like every therapist has a Kleenex box, because when you talk about sad things, they feel the feeling of sad. Mm-hmm. We're not mean. We're actually very nice. But like when you think anxious things, you'll feel the feeling of anxiety. And that's another part of diffusion, basically, that when you have the cognition and then the emotion shows up, is that ability to recognize all of this is just the weird thing human bodies do. They produce thoughts, they produce emotions. And not all of that is big and important.
Yeah. So an interesting question that popped up for me when you were explaining that is, and again, I would say kind of broader generalization, if you were to ask the OCD treatment community, they tend to associate or think, pair, act with this values-based work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think values is a huge piece of that. Where I think it might get tricky for people listening is they might go, okay, so I have certain emotion that comes up with different words or different associations. And ultimately, isn't the value also the emotion or meaning that I bring to different words or concepts or associations? And so how would you separate or differentiate emotion and what you mean when you're like, but this is a value-driven thing? Because a lot of people kind of use it synonymously, and I think you're making an important distinction.
Yes, values are things that we care about. They are not things that feel good. And I'd say to the listener, like, think about things you care about, and that are they always associated with fun, love, enjoyment? No, some of the things we care about are really hard, and they're sad, and they're difficult. And I mean, have you ever done homework with like a 12-year-old? Like, you probably love your 12-year-old and you want them to succeed, but that process is probably the opposite of fun. It's probably frustrating and annoying and brings up all sorts of emotions and cognitions that you don't enjoy, but you probably value helping your kid grow and learn. So values are just things we care about. And that's right. That's another like kind of metacognitive skill of recognizing that I care about it because I care about it. I don't care about it because how it makes me feel. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if they pair up. Like sometimes it happens. Like sometimes the things I care about are also fun. But I'd argue a lot of what we care about is associated with all sorts of emotions. And back to our texting thing, I shut it off and they're still shooting through, right? I just like getting the string of them. And back to the diffusion, right? Can I just notice that happened, put my attention back on you. Like I don't have to buy into these pop-ups that are happening on my computer.
Yeah. And if we were to add on the layer of emotion, it's not that we can't be human and be like, oh, I'm annoyed that that's still going on. But that doesn't mm-hmm. mean you have to choose to engage with it. You can let that experience come and go. And ultimately, as you continue to participate where we are now, you're able to let it be.
And if you don't mind me finishing off what is ACT. So diffusion is being able to see the thought. And then the next thing is the A, acceptance, which is now literally practicing allowing it to be there, mm-hmm. right? As it is. And then while you're allowing it to be there, what behavior do you want to engage in? Well, that's your values. And at some level, if you get those three things, you have a pretty strong understanding of ACT, like seeing thoughts and emotions for what they are, allowing them to be there, choosing what actions you actually want to engage in this moment.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a conversation with a past client where we were talking about, because often in part of the psychoeducation we do around OCD is that OCD is ego dystonic. And so for mm-hmm. anybody new joining us, my cheat sheet example, there's more to it, but is that this isn't who you want to be. It's not aligned with your values. It's not congruent in any way versus something that's egocentric, where it's lockstep with who we identify ourselves to be. And so, you know, I remember talking with this client and they were like, but my value is to not harm children. Going back to kind of the obsession around fears and harm OCD. And it was very tricky for them to be able to differentiate because they value that. That's why they were, you know, participating in the compulsions. And so values gets defined and stretched, the meaning of it, and kind of wrapped around, and is a little bit, and sometimes that takes away from the meaning of what we actually mean when we say values. And so what would you say to anyone listening that might feel similarly or getting stuck on that?
Okay. You know, it's funny when I said these three things in my mind, I was like, well, you really four, the last piece makes it a lot better. So the last piece is behavioral commitments. So you notice your thoughts, you make room for them, you connect with who you want to be. And then the last part is, and then you do that, right? That's honestly, if anyone's listening to me lecture on ACT, I'll say, if you get these four things, you got it. So they may value not harming kids. I'm assuming you and I value not harming kids.
Yeah.
But what are the actions you should then do that are in line with that value? And so if you really sat down and had like a reasonable conversation about, all right, so what are you going to do on a daily basis? Too. And probably the value of not harming kids should probably be my value is supporting kids. Because like I value not doing something. It's kind of, it's always better to say it like a proactive way. I value supporting kids. All right. So what would that look like on a daily basis? I value that. I have a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old. My 19-year-old's off at college. So that's probably, I don't know, send one text every other day. Like that's probably how I support that kid. My 17-year-old who's in the house, that is probably have dinner with her. I don't know, have a conversation with her, watch a TV show with her, have a conversation, but not too long of one because really long ones annoy her, right? Like that's how I enact that value. But I can imagine people who I don't want to harm kids. So the way I'll enact that value is not drive a car. I've had clients, right? I won't take a bus near school hours, so I'm not near children. I won't walk past schools.
Or playgrounds or anything that, yeah.
Yeah, and then if we got into the behavioral commitment, that's not really how you do that. That's not really how you do that value.
Right.
Like, and then if we go into the values of like, I want to be a community member or a family member or a friend, well, some of those are going to stop matching. Like, I won't go over to my friend's house because she has kids. But if you value being a friend, then you value supporting children. Well, then I think the commitment would be go to that house, hang out with your friend, say something nice to the child. That's that. That's actually how you enact that value. And I would not do it with a client like this. Here's what you should do.
Right.
But that would be like weeks of therapy of helping them sort of appreciate how this all works.
The difference versus mitigating potential possible risks.
Right.
That really came from a thought. And thoughts aren't facts. Thoughts are thoughts. And so we're enacting on it like we need to call in the National Guard because you might be this actual threat to the kid. And when really, like you're saying, living to your value then in that situation would be supporting the kid, donating to the PTA, or helping someone with their homework. If it's a baby, changing their diaper because they're soiled, things like that.
Right. And then back to the diffusion and acceptance. If you engage in that value, we are confident that your mind is going to kick and scream and say all sorts of things. And now it's our job to notice those thoughts, see them for what they are, practice not listening to them. I did a project, I sound like I'm a name dropper and I'm not trying to be that, but I did a big project with John Abramowitz, who's, you know, great at ERP, certainly like the world's expert. And he said, and at this, I usually say I can like talk about people if I'm complimenting them. Like he said, ACT is probably one of the better forms of response prevention you can have. Right. So like response prevention historically in ERP is like, don't
compulse.
When you're having, don't do that. But what does that mean to don't?
Right.
Like don't, this is like actively notice, actively see that as a thought, practice making room for it. It's like, he's like, it gave me language to say how to not do it. It's
right.
Like, instead of don't do that, it's like, go do these things. Work on recognizing the thoughts. Work on noticing your emotion. See it as pop-ups on your computer. Think of it like an announcer at a sporting event. Practice like walking around and listening to it. Like it gave strategy to response prevention.
Yeah, I like that. My specialty before getting into the OCD realm here was in early intervention birth to five services. And I helped manage a first five LA grant in Los Angeles and was a program manager for the birth to five program and supervisor. And a lot of things, too, when if you have a parent bringing in their child and they're like, don't do this. I mean, what's the child supposed to do with that? Right. Like, OK, but what do I do instead? Right. And so often, I think not always, but so often in the exposure and response prevention world, anything else we could put in there, well, that's it could just be functioning as another compulsion or as avoidance. Mm-hmm. But we do need to be able to have some strategies and focus on the behavior we do want to see. So what would it mean to live life during this time? You know, you need to get to work and you're avoiding and having, you know, maybe a 20-minute commute where it would have been five because you feel afraid that you can't drive past a school. Well, then what would it mean to live life and have a little extra time at home or a little bit extra charge in your battery because you can drive 5 minutes to work and not have to take the 20-minute route?
Right.
And so being able to focus on living and engaging in your life. And so I can see his point in that. And John's been on the show here as well and has written a book, Family. You know, we've talked about it with John for the family in terms of ways to help family members when they have OCD. But I can see how that would be particularly useful, too, in the BFRB realm. And again, family, that's body-focused repetitive behaviors, because so often, in a parent-child example, for example, if you have somebody that struggles with, we've talked about hair pulling, but it could be many different things, skin picking, cheek chewing, any of that, they could come in and be like, don't do that. And often it's a response of their own anxiety or their own distress in seeing their loved one engage in that behavior. But at the same time, what are they supposed to do?
Right.
And so offering those alternatives of like, okay, so what do we want to do and live life? And can we allow room for our brain to brain and live our life? And we need some guidance. So just simply saying like, don't do that. Okay. But it serves a function. So if you're not adding in something that is going to serve the function of living your life, then people are stuck. And the thoughts can be so overwhelming that sometimes they do just need a simple map of like, okay, well, what does that mean to live life? Well, okay, how long would you like it to take to get to work? Well, it's 5 minutes away and I miss it being that trip. Okay, so what can we do to work on that? What can we do to actually do that drive and things of that matter? And so I think that's a really good point. And I can see, again, how that would be really helpful in the BFRB world as well.
Yeah.
How would that get applied in the tick world? And one thing I would say is from what I have learned about ticks too, it's partly the appraisal. Sometimes the tick can be bothersome for the people around the person with tick. And for the person with the tick, they might be like, I feel okay with this. Other times it's very distressing for the person with the tick, and that's something they want to work on. Again, similar kind of to body-focused repetitive behaviors, you got to follow the lead of the person with the lived experience. But how do you see that? I'm just curious, manifest in support for someone with a tick disorder.
So I'm going to start at the beginning of that, and I'll try to get to, I think your question was like how to help, like a family. Okay. Take a tick disorder. People who describe before they have a tick, they have it, like say it's an arm tick, they'll have a tingle in their shoulder or in their arm, and then they kind of do the twitch thing, and then it makes that feeling a little better until, you know, it starts to build up again later. Same thing with like a vocal tick. They'll have a tickle in their throat. And then when they clear it, it goes away and slowly starts to build up. Right. Which is the exact same story for trick. Right. Like have thoughts about hairs. You have tingles in certain areas. It doesn't look right. OCD. You do your compulsion. The obsession feels a little bit less for a bit until it starts to grow or you're prompted by something. I think when people... I'm not saying therapists teach this, but if someone doesn't have good language for what to do with all that feeling, then people will just naturally power through it. Like if I just wait it out, it'll go away. And I think for some people that could work. I think there's a lot of people who like, if I just wait, it'll go away. And then it never happens. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think a big part of like when exposure work works, it's because the people naturally figured out some kind of like, I'm going to need to make room for this in my life. Like I'm going to need to allow this feeling to be there. And I think some therapists teach it really well. Like they got that. Mm-hmm. And some it kind of happens by accident. Honestly, I'm saying if ERP doesn't work, it's probably because you're trying to power through the exposures. And if you can somehow foster an openness to it and a curiosity and an interest in watching what your body does, that's how I think it will work. And what does it work mean? I would say that these internal experiences stop pushing you around as much. I would not say they go away. Okay. I think they get contextualized. So I think without openness, you can call it acceptance, you can call it tolerance, you can call it, you know, whatever word is in that ballpark. I think you need that to make therapy work. Mm-hmm. And without it, you have an issue. Then that's one thing that I think just gets missed. And I think you can do traditional ERP, but you need a little bit of that language of how to be open to the internal stuff. Otherwise, I think you're going to struggle forever as a therapist or as a client.
Yeah.
Your question was, how would a family member support mm-hmm. someone who's going and with someone tics or OCD? I think appreciating that, mm-hmm. that this individual, the family member does not have the skill to experience the emotion that they're having, whether it be a premonitory urge with a tic, urge mm-hmm. to pull, an obsession. And it's going to take a long time to build that up. Mm-hmm. And so if the longer they've had OCD or whatever, the longer they've been building it up or the more severe it was, mm-hmm. the more work it's going to take, and just backing them up as they build that up. And so I'll give an analogy. My wife's a personal trainer and like we work out together. Mm-hmm. And I know she looks at me and she's like, your form stinks. Why are you doing that? You don't get where your knee should be. It's just like, I can tell she's like biting her tongue. And she gives me like just enough feedback, like just like one little tip, because that's all I can work on today. And I'd say just like, think your family members like that. Like they're working, they're making like 1% improvement. They can't do the huge thing. So if they like are just at least going in the right direction, but still not pulling it off a bunch of the time, learning new skills are really hard. So just like giving them the support as they learn it, and they're not going to be able to just like flip the switch. Mm-hmm. They're going to just keep learning how to have this really difficult feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's no different than how am I going to learn great weightlifting form? Practice, 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 coaching, coaching, coaching. Mm-hmm. But it's still going to take a year.
Yeah.
Until I learn it.
Yeah. Well, and I always think, too, it's a bit of a parallel process, right? Because your loved one has the autonomy to choose. And it's also a matter of us, too, kind of wrapping our mind around what are our expectations here. Because when it comes to something that is neurologically based, we can work and improve and lower distress. But for the example of, say, you know, hair pulling, it's not that a BFRB is just going to disappear. We can't eradicate it. And it's
right.
This person's brain, right? And so they are sometimes going to pull, or maybe that will mm-hmm. shift into another area. And often, even if they've learned different skills and tools and aren't using it in that moment, often for the example of a parent, their own anxiety and distress in seeing their loved one engage in that. Maybe they've done a really good job. And so they're like, oh, you've done so well. You can't sabotage this, right? They feel their own distress. It's a bit of a parallel process. And so, again, it's focusing, what is something that I can do and that I can even accept that they're a person that also needs to feel supported, that they have been doing a really good job. And so much shame can enter in if
yeah.
they're like, gosh,
yeah.
I picked. And then you're like, why? Why would you do that? Your eyebrows are just now growing back, things like that. And so, again, it's really allowing that distress even in as a parent and going, I can accept, as upsetting as it may feel, I can accept what's happening here. I can lean in to the tools that I've learned. And chances are, if your child has a BFRB and is receiving any kind of treatment, then you've received some support and coaching too as a parent on how to best
right.
support your loved one. But it is a bit of a parallel process as well. And so I think, you know, it's part of the reason why if you have a loved one that's engaging in any of these treatment models, it's so helpful and important, and why we talk about it in this family community all the time, for you to also understand why and how that functions. and really how you learning and also implementing some of those skills is ultimately going to help your loved one be able to not only feel supported and joined and not alone in that, but help them. Because sometimes our reaction can reinforce a response, the behaviors that we choose. So if it's value driven again, how do we pursue values versus what we're not doing? It's that parallel process.
Absolutely. And like ACT is kind of neat that way, because caregivers, parents, we're going to have thoughts that aren't our favorite, and we're going to have emotions that aren't our favorite. And then if we slow down and think about who do we want to be in this moment, what do we value, that the behaviors we're going to do that are in line with those values are not always going to be easy. Mm-hmm. And they're going to produce their own sort of difficult emotions and interesting little struggles. So we can practice a similar thing that our loved ones are practicing. Like, I had a funny one. My son's off to college right now. And boy, when he was heading off to college, I was like, internally, I want to instill every life lesson, right, that he's going to need. And I'd be like, oh, he doesn't know about this. He doesn't know about this. Doesn't know about this. And what I found is every time I gave a life lesson, he sort of checked out more and like wanted less to do with me.
Right.
So the emotion, the egocentric thing would be like, teach all these things. But honestly, if I connect with my values, which is just having a good relationship with my children, where they like want to be part of my life, the behavior was keep your mouth shut and like talk about video games. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when you check with your values, the behavior you should do is not the one that feels the most comfortable, but it actually produces the best thing.
Right.
Right. So sometimes there's nothing to say because the kid already knows it.
Yeah.
Like, and saying it just makes you feel better. It doesn't actually move anything forward. And I'm 1,000% aware that whatever parent here that's listening is like, well, you're not in this situation. You know, my heart, like, I have lots of clients and I know the hard things people go through. Right. So I like empathize how hard it is to keep a mouth shut and just like let the kid work through it that day. Right. It's not just that easy. Probably in the same way, it's not just that easy to not listen to an obsession.
Right.
They're hard.
I see
things.
That parallel. You know, something I will say is, and not to just poo-poo on Dr. Phil, but I'm not a huge fan of Dr. Phil. Okay. But he does have one phrase, no person's all bad, and I'm not saying he's bad. But but I don't necessarily agree with his philosophy of psychology. But he will say something that I think behaviorists overall will agree with. And that mantra is, how's that working for you? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so also, yeah, we can't know what every person's position is and they can't know what our position is. But we didn't get to the point of seeking help because the tools we were using were so incredibly effective. We got to this place and said, we need a team and we need to brainstorm about this, because ultimately coming in and saying, stop, don't do that, you just got your eyebrows back, was not helping. And may have led to even greater distress, that may have led to greater pulling episodes, et cetera. Or same can go with OCD and how our response, or maybe even participating. Fine, you're worried about opening the door. I'll just open the door. Come on, we got to go. You know, those little things that we're doing. And so what I would say is, you know, looking at the function is always going to be important. A function for them, function for you. So if we're going, you know what, I'm trying my best, and I believe that, and I say a lot here on the show, thank you for loving your person well. You know, even taking the time to listen to the show, there's just a million other things you could do. And
yeah, totally.
You're choosing because you're going, I feel like it could get better, or I feel like I need to know I'm not alone in this. And so looking at the function and going, I have grace and empathy and self-compassion for the fact that I got frustrated and maybe kind of snapped at the person.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this isn't functioning well. It's not leading us where we want to be. And so being able to look at that and go, okay, so something's got to change. Have grace for ourselves when we're going to be human, and there's going to be, it's not always going to go quickly, but the goal isn't perfection. It's really managing those expectations and going, okay, what can I do? So if my value is to help my kid, and I know that, and I've heard and I've learned through the function of this that it's not working well for me, then how can I respond in a way that's loving for them? Okay, well, What maybe something we talked about was I come up and give them a hug, or I wait till later and then I say, hey, how are you doing? And there's a lot of different ways that could roll out.
Well, and what's crossing my mind is what's kind of cool about the concept of a value, that a value is this is the kind of person I want to be in this moment. And sometimes that's a parent who's warm, compassionate, loving, open, but there could be an example where you're a parent who's overly warm, loving, compassionate, open, and you need to make some policies and stick by them. Mm-hmm. And telling your kid that here's, okay, this is maybe not an OCD example, but telling your kid this is the curfew and maintaining that curfew, there are parents who are going to give in because their kid's going to be distressed by having the early curfew, and they don't want to see their kid distressed, and they don't want to get in a discussion. So then they give in to something that's not actually consistent with their values. And so sometimes even following our values is doing things that are hard for us. Mm-hmm. So like I can picture a moment where like I've worked with, like I've had this recently where the husband and wife both get on the phone call and the husband's a client. And we agree we're going to talk to the wife about stop helping me do my compulsions. We're at that point and we kind of sit down and have a conversation with her about here's the things we're going to stop. Right there is an ACT moment for the wife, because it's going to be really hard to watch him be in distress.
Right.
But if that's the value, to not give reassurance, to let him work through this moment, right? There's a moment for her to use her ACT skills of noticing what she's thinking and feeling and allowing it and connecting with why she wants to do this and then following through on it. So I think big point here is like, what does a value look like? Well, it's different for every person in every situation. Mm-hmm. How, like, what do you, the thing you need to do? Yeah, you may just need to sit down for 5 minutes and think, what do I care about and what do I want to be doing here? And what are the things I need to start doing differently to make this work?
Yeah, and values can shift and morph over time, and so can you. So you can go, you know, I used to really value or conceptualize my value as I want to help my loved one not have another spot. But then I can value, like, actually, I want her to know, like, and not feel like everything is performance based and on whether or not she picks or not. And so I'm shifting the value to loving and rooting her on. I was trying to do that before, but I'm now shifting what that looks like for me.
Right.
Being able to follow that process. And so I think it's a really good, and again, I kind of come back to this word, maybe it's just a word that's on my brain anyway, of empowerment, of feeling like empowered to be able to, because so often I think, especially in something like traditional ERP, we feel, especially as parents or loved ones, we can feel disempowered because we're like, crap. Everything I've been doing has been like reinforcing OCD and I feel terrible. And instead we feel empowered and be like, no, I can still love my person. And that may need to be applied differently than I realized, but I'm still getting to love my person and getting to move forward and have the confidence too that loving them in this way is going to help that get to them and not have OCD or BFRB or tics interfere with that. And so I think that's definitely, for not being in the game of managing emotions, I think it can bring a lot of that relief and for people to actually get to feel like, okay, I can love my person. I can connect to them with that, which is a wonderful thing.
Hey, real talk. If you've made it this far into the pod, chances are you love learning about OCD. So why not take it up a notch? Head over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to browse the OCD Training School's incredible lineup. And when you use my special link, you're not just investing in great education, you're also supporting this podcast at zero extra cost. With courses ranging from self-help to continuing education for clinicians, offering live and on-demand options to fit your needs or your time zone, the opportunities are vast. OCD Training School has your back. And when you use my link, you have the fam's back too. So go check it out at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And now, back to the show.
So I know you didn't ask me this question, but we've kind of walked into this territory and I think it's worth talking about.
Sure.
Like, how values and exposure exercises link together.
Mm-hmm.
So in my lab forever, we will do an exposure exercise with a client, except we're not going to watch habituation. Like, we're not going to collect a SUD score and bring it up to a certain point and then stay in that situation and watch that SUD score drop. Because what that's kind of saying is the goal of this work is to produce habituation, right?
And tolerate the stress, like embrace it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I would be a little more open to saying the goal of this work is in that tolerate distress zone. But that is literally the big picture goal. Like the big picture goal is to learn how to have obsessions and feelings that we don't like and thoughts that we don't enjoy, to learn how to let them be there when they're there. It's like to learn how to be you regardless of what's happening inside. So when we do an exposure in my group, it's really just an opportunity to practice having your internal experience and not buying into it. So we don't even ask how high or low it got. We're just practicing being in a difficult situation. But here's where the values tie in. We almost always practice in situations that have some purpose. Like, what is something that you would like in your life, or you would like back in your life, or that this actually happens for you? And then we build up the skill of how to be in these difficult life situations. And the interesting thing is, like, if we've worked with hundreds, right? I'm trying to think how long I've been doing this. Like, we've worked with hundreds of clients. Very few times have we ever done an exposure that is not linked to a value in some way. So we don't do a lot of like just disgusting, disturbing things. Because it's like, well, where would that be in this person's life? Like, if we don't need this to be a 90 or 100, if that's not a goal of ours, everything we do can tie to a value in some ways. And sometimes it's kind of a goofy way. It's like, all right, you want to be more used to germs so that you can go to restaurants. Why don't we walk around and touch doorknobs? And maybe touching doorknobs isn't a value, but it's really easy to link that to, well, this is going to be part of my life. Like, if I go to a restaurant, open a restaurant at the door, I touch the table when I sit down. The cutlery, I didn't wash it, right? I'm going to get what I get. And can we practice having that because you want to go to dinner with your partner?
Right.
And we've been able to do that. And this is kind of a big talk in OCD in like the last 6 months, maybe a year of, I think we've recognized we were doing some exposures that were just over the top, sort of without a lot of purpose. And that's coming out of favor. I think you can get really good outcomes without having to. And actually, we have a study out where we ran an ACT versus ERP trial, but we coded all the videos without the coders knowing which condition the people were in. And we just coded what happened in the therapy session, and then we tracked it to outcome. And the variable most associated with good outcome, which is even beyond time spent doing exposure, was a good acceptance tolerance rationale. Like the more the client understood the concept of acceptance tolerance, the better they got.
Interesting.
Beyond everything else.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. And these are, right, these aren't ACT clients. These are ERP and ACT clients mixed together.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. It makes me think of, again, the mastery approach, which definitely is built to incorporate some ACT values as well, but very much is prioritizing a readiness of the client to approach that. And that, again, like, yeah, we don't have to do sensational exposures for exposure's sake.
Right.
Right. It's kind of like jumping out of a plane. I mean, unless you're in some kind of military service where you might have to jump out of a plane.
Right. Right.
Who has to jump out of a plane? Right.
Well, or like, okay, again, Utah religious community. I've had some like straight up scrupulosity cases. Like I'm afraid of doing a religious infraction in a religious context. We don't need to go do religious infractions.
Right.
Like just being in a church is enough work. Having religious conversations in church is hard enough. Opening religious documents in church and reading them, having a conversation, saying you disagree with something in church, like all this is way enough work. And I think the clients appreciate that we never had to go in there and do something wrong, because where is that? There's no value there, but there probably is a value to being at a like a Bible study and saying, like, I don't really agree with that take, which for somebody is probably very hard. But if you're in Bible study, that's, I'm assuming that's a line that could come out of someone's mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And having a value-driven conversation on faith is different than trying to confess or solve or get reassurance about a mental health issue that can show up in faith. And that is part of the thing with scrupulosity is that, and for anybody listening that's like, scrupa what?
No.
Fun word. Use it in Scrabble. You get a lot of points. But scrupulosity is really talking. It can manifest in both religious and moral situations. But really that doing right or wrong, you know, and can really tie in a lot with existential issues of, you know, am I going to hell if I believe there's a hell? Even if I don't believe there's a hell, am I going to hell? Am I a good person? Did I somehow offend my higher power, whatever the situation might be? And so, yeah, I mean, absolutely, that's going to come up. And I've talked with Dr. Caitlin Pinciotti. She's out of Baylor, and she's done a lot of work in justice-based ERP. And this is a conference.
That's the word I was blanking on. Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. There's, I mean, it's important because we've talked about even, you know, one of the examples that I've recently shared on the show, she's been on talking about this as well, is like, you know, if somebody has, for example, an intrusive thought show up where they think a racial slur and they're like, oh my gosh, I abhor that thought came into my mind. I don't feel this way about other people. I'm like, what does this mean about me? You know, all these different things. We would never do the exposure where you get comfortable doing racial slurs and really is like, oh, you know, I'm still able to kind of live life and whatever, because that's not value driven at all. Like we don't want to use people
as
props or religion or people's faith as props in that. And so being able to go, and it makes a lot of sense for the acceptance and tolerance with mastery approach. It's very much about mastering the practice of being in different conditions as well, kind of those behavioral experiments, more or less, with an idea of readiness and an allowance for even judicious safety behaviors. If it's a low cost, big gain, gets you towards practicing being able to, you know, in your example, go to restaurants, right? So what would that mean? Would that mean being able to go and feel okay practicing walking near the restaurant or walking through the food court in the mall? And then eventually I'm going to sit down at a seat and then I'm going to practice being able to order. But it definitely has that underpinning that really infuses those ACT concepts, which I think is really helpful and really important. Like, it's not that we shouldn't be driving bicycles just for driving bicycles' sake, but if we have a utility and something's functional and we're not utilizing that functional path because we're afraid because it goes by a school, then that's something where it's worth accepting and tolerating, like you were saying. And I like the way that you described that. I think that's helpful.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a paper that we'll probably have to write in the next year or two, but like, we've been writing on values-based exposures. And then, you know, I saw my first talk on justice-based ERP, you know, Jeff Szymanski and Monica Williams and all them, I think Chad Weirnick, like they did something at IOCDF. And I was like, this is great. But then the next thing I was like, but if you were doing ACT, you would have never got to that place, because we would never have to go habituate to something weird. And so I think at some point I got to write the paper, like, linking them.
Yeah.
Because when they were talking about it, I was like, I didn't think of it like that. I didn't call it that, but I would never have asked someone to do something that is against their values just to get used to the emotion.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have come up. It would be kind of antithetical to an ACT model.
Well, and again, it just goes back to the point, you know, a lot of what justice-based ERP will look at is something like, you know, particularly if you think of a subtype like sexual orientation OCD. In the past, people would use different names for that. And they would also maybe dress up in a pride flag and waltz around town, and not because they are of the LGBTQI plus community, but because they were doing an extreme exposure. And for what value? And what does that mean for people that do identify in that community? Does it feel like, you know, you're ultimately parading around and playing pretend? And I think any of us wouldn't love the idea of someone pretending as the extreme exposure. And so I think part of what justice-based ERP came out of that. But another piece that I've talked with Caitlin a lot, and you're echoing, and I think that would be a helpful paper, is that so often people miss the core fear then when it comes to exposure therapy. They miss kind of what is the thing I'm really worried about, right? So what is the thing that we're kind of targeting when I'm afraid that I could hurt a child because I had a thought or an image that was really disturbing to me. And again, it doesn't mean we perpetuate or reenact an abusive situation in the sake of exposure, because that's not ultimately, you're missing the point on that. But also, like you're saying, that acceptance and tolerance, like you would have never engaged in that exposure in the first place. And that's something that is striking to me, because even when I was BTTI trained, which again, more acronyms I know, fam, is the Behavioral Therapy Training Institute. But this is supposed to be, and not supposed to, it is one of the creme de la creme kind of trainings for ERP, myself included, I'll be first to say, was missing some of the pieces of what, you know, exposure we get conceptually, response prevention and good response prevention we've struggled with. And so I would imagine too, because John is such a strong voice in the research community, that when John Abramowitz was like, yes, I mean, good response prevention is and includes ACT inherently, that probably really helped for ACT to get a bit of a voice in that realm around what does good ERP look like.
Yeah. I mean, John's fantastic. He, one thing that I thought was very cool, like we spent many years doing projects together and he spent the time learning it. Like he took on cases and I did the consultation on the cases. Like how many old professors, editor of journals are like, let me take on cases and have this younger person watch them and like give me feedback on how I'm doing my work. Like, no, he's a cool scientist and that he really worked to learn it. And back to your point about the sort of interesting twist on exposure therapy. Like I told you, I worked at the University of British Columbia in their OCD clinic. And, you know, those are the most, they worked from a CT or traditional CBT standpoint. And I never did exposures that big again. That was the gummy bears on a toilet seat and then eating them world. And like, yeah, like my view of germs were pretty different after that. Yeah. Like we had a pretty good shift. But after that time, I went back to the ACT model is like, there's no value in that. Like, this is not something I want in my life. I can find enough challenge from eating dinner without washing my hands, which, you know, anyone been to a wedding, it's like, you're ready to eat and somebody shakes your hand and like, what are you going to do? Stand up and walk all the way to the bathroom, wash your hand again. Like,
yeah,
you eat and it's not your favorite and it's what it is. And, you know, those challenges, there's just enough of those in everyone's day to day.
Yeah, it's interesting. And for anybody listening or particularly newer to the community, whether your loved one struggles with contamination form of OCD or not, you might be like, why? Pardon me. Did you say eating gummy bears off of a toilet seat? Why would I?
It's weird
I?
How this seems so normal.
Right,
that I just
right.
Said
and,
that.
For,
yeah.
And for us in the treatment world, we're like, yep, yeah, another Tuesday. But I think there's also value in going, yeah, why would we do that? Because short of somebody putting, you know, a gun to your head and say, eat this gummy bear off a toilet seat or else, there's really not a lot of practical, real world situations where it's going to come down to eat the gummy bear off a toilet seat or not. But how ERP can function or how these behavioral experiments, you know, whether you're infusing it with exposure therapy or not and practicing ACT can function is important in terms of you've talked about habituation, having the brain learn that this threat isn't the threat that we perceived it to be. And the more we stuck with it, we realized actually I come down from my nervous system being in fight, flight or freeze and the false alarm gets turned off. But also, and what you were highlighting even in that, I think it was that study that you were talking about where the acceptance and tolerance skills were what was shining through. Like I can accept and tolerate this situation. It's interesting. You said you have a couple kids. I have three kids. And when my firstborn, I think any parent of a firstborn, it's a radical change for a parent's life to be like, I'm going to go to dinner now to like, you have a kid and you're like, oh my gosh, you feel completely at the mercy of this little person that is completely dependent on you. But I remember there's that giraffe called Sophie or something like that. And it's a teething toy. And it's a popular one. And it's, you know, all the things free that you want that your little one could be teething on. And so I remember with the firstborn, Sophie fell on the carpet at my own house. And I was like, we need to boil Sophie. We need to sanitize Sophie.
That's right.
All of this. By my third kid, I could have been at a car mechanic's and dropped Sophie and be like, brush it off, 10-second rule. And it goes to say, the more practice you have, but also kind of resetting those expectations. And I would argue that some of that acceptance and tolerance is allowing yourself mm-hmm. to be flexible with mm-hmm. resetting some of those expectations and going, well, maybe I was a little overboard. Because I think most of us, I'm a third child in my own nuclear family. I'm telling you that the life I lived was dramatically different from that of my oldest sibling. And that's just partly through practice. You start to learn like some of this stuff that I was really like very concerned about. So some of it I learned, yes, this is good to be concerned about. And some of it was like, it doesn't matter. I can allow it to come. I can allow it to go. It's not going to be the end all be all. And from an exposure standpoint, then, you know, those youngest kids might have a little bit of a stronger immune system and able to capable to fight a little more because they did have Sophie off the garage floor versus the boiled carpet Sophie. And so in terms of when we're thinking about OCD treatment, then ACT can really stand alone. It can be infused and really helpful for ERP mm-hmm. for the reasons you were just saying, that acceptance and tolerance can be such an asset. But can you tell people more about where they can find more information or maybe even some good resources that you would recommend them looking into if they're newer to learning about ACT or if they're hearing this and they're like, you know what, I think that could be really helpful for my loved one or even for me as the supporter of my loved one being able to accept and tolerate this process for them?
Oh my gosh. I mean, so I've been a professor for 20 years, so been doing this job longer than that. Over that time, we've certainly built up a lot of material. And the purpose of that is to get information into clients' hands, get information into professionals' hands. So there's so many self-help books on ACT that describe this. There's a nice one on OCD by Marissa Marza. There's a good one on OCD by Patricia Zarita Ona. Mm-hmm. I have one that's called The Anxious Perfectionist with my colleague Clarissa Ung, which, you know, is kind of geared at perfectionism. I think people with OCD and skin picking, hair pulling would probably gain a lot out of it. You'd learn kind of the way we talk about it. If you go to my website, we've built a lot of web-based interventions. We have a whole suite of them for trichotillomania, skin picking, hair pulling, which is trick, hoarding. We have general ones. I mean, that's one of our lines of research, is we build these web-based interventions and test them. And if you're a professional, probably the big thing is I have a really well produce training of how to do ACT-based exposures across all the anxiety disorders. And that's been out for 2 or 3 years and has been received quite well. I think, honestly, it's better than I could do in person because we brought in all these like clients, and they're not real clients. They're mental health professionals who are willing to showcase their OCD.
Yeah.
So it kind of got around the confidentiality thing. And it's just the best illustration of ACT or anxiety and OCD that I could come up with. So there's just a lot out there after 20 years of doing this work. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And so I am going to have everything linked. Anybody who's been with us for a hot minute knows I always put our show notes over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. But if you're newer with us, please know I realize we're doing lots of things during podcasts, myself included. Not when I'm recording them per se, but when I'm listening, I'm washing things, I'm running, I'm driving, I'm drifting off to sleep. And so all of that information is going to be linked over on the blog. So as we wrap up our time together, I would love to hear, and I know you said you're thinking just as we're talking now about how you can really kind of speak into that fusion, for lack of a better term, of justice-based ERP and what ACT supports as well. But I would love to know, because of the unique position you're in, and I'm sure oversee different dissertations, et cetera, I would love to hear where you kind of see research moving for ACT and, you know, where you hope to see it expand from here.
Yes, huge question. In my lab, which I run with my colleague Mike Levin, the OCD and related disorders suite is, we haven't even built out into certain areas of it. So that's going to keep happening. We're going to have like the technology of how you can use this with like body dysmorphic disorder or, you know, Tourette syndrome is not really built out very well. I have a colleague doing a lot of hoarding. So anyways, we're going to keep building that out. And then I think the other thing is there's pieces in here, like values as an example. That's a thing that a lot of people use, whether or not they do ACT. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying we thought of values, but we probably built it out more than other people. Mm-hmm. I think the world of building out these smaller technologies and assisting other professionals into bringing them into their work is something that we're going to be doing over time. So you probably hear like Steve Hayes and Stefan Hoffman talk about like process-based therapy, which is really that, which is like recognizing your clients have these things happening for them. And then there's pieces of different interventions that match those issues that people have. So rather than, you know, winging it as an eclectic therapist, that there's going to be kind of technologies that guide you and how to put the pieces together. Yeah, if I had to buy stock, that's probably in 20 years, probably what's going to be built out.
Yeah. And you know, just in thinking about that and for process-based disorders, even, you know, I think it was while we were recording, you had mentioned an example of even like porn addiction, right? But I think of another, you know, whether it's substance use or eating disorder, I think of as some of those more process-based disorders as well. And so you're seeing like there's room, and we already know it, particularly from more broadly our OCD research, that a lot of these evidence-based therapies that help with OCD can be very, very helpful in those areas as well. And so it sounds like testing or building a base for the utilization of ACT in those areas too, and technologies, which I think is smart because that's our world is moving more and more technological by the day. And so being able to lean into that, I'm sure there would be avid interest. And I think it's smart to have that grow with kind of how culture is growing technologically.
Right. Yeah, you're kind of summing up our work. We grow into these other areas, and then we find ways to get the good work into people's hands. And there's always more than we can accomplish, which I guess means you're doing a good line of research when you're never done doing your work.
Yeah. And I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I really feel like you are kind of the epicenter of the growing research base for ACT there in Utah. And not to say that nobody else is studying ACT, but you're really at the forefront and known in terms of generating more and more of this research. And so it's just another acknowledgement and another moment to express my gratitude for you taking the time. And it's exciting to hear about where this could go, because I'm sure most of us, hopefully most of us listening, are going, yeah, I mean, that kind of just makes sense. It almost feels common sense to be like, yeah, wouldn't in all of these different areas, we want to be able to learn how to really target what we value, except that not every thought is going to be a golden one, and that we don't have to let that limit our life from moving towards the life that we want. And yeah, I mean, it really does. So I appreciate your time. And any final thoughts before we go?
I don't think so, other than thanks a lot. I think a lot about like each of our roles in life. And, you know, my role, I think, is largely, like I sit at this computer and we run studies, and then we write papers about those studies, and then we write books about summing up all the papers we wrote.
Right.
And like one of your roles in life is helping get all these cool ideas out to people. Mm-hmm. And thank you for doing that, because we need people like you doing that role, because otherwise these things I develop in this office at a university, I'm not very good at getting it out to people. So thanks for having me on here and you know, helping us do that next step that I'm not good at, but you're good at. So you make that happen. So thanks for doing what you do.
Well, thank you. And, you know, something we say here a lot is we're better together. And it's true, right? You have a special knowledge base and an understanding of running ethical and productive research. And I have an appreciation for that, but I don't have that same skill set. But when we combine it together, then all of us can, you know, benefit from it. And so I appreciate that, and appreciate what you do too. And keep up the good work, Mike. I hope
you too.
Stay in touch. Would love to talk again at some point in the future, but really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Intrusive thoughts. Okay, family. So what did you think? I really appreciated that conversation, how ACT functions and the benefit of getting out there and living and practicing and doing life. And honestly, I remember benefiting from our initial conversation, but just as I was preparing our interview for you, I recognized like this feels so pertinent and so helpful and so applicable to life now, to clients' lives now, to my family's life now, for my loved ones with OCD or without. So for today's intrusive thought segment, which for newer family joining us is the application segment of the show, where I try to take everything that we've heard and distill it into at least one practical tip or idea that we can practice this week, that we can say, okay, I heard the episode, it all sounded really great, but how does that look in real life? And we think about that together and come up with an idea that we can practice. So I'm going to invite us to try practicing accepting and tolerating by using the simple but powerful mindfulness exercise. Some of you might be familiar with it. Some of you might have a hard time engaging with it. Mindfulness exercises. But hear me out, fam, okay? Hear me out. So I want you to find a space. I generally would recommend a quiet space. But, you know, for some of y'all, you're like, if I don't have music jamming in the background or something playing, I cannot focus. So you know your brain best. Find a space that's going to be most helpful for you. Then here's what I want you to do. I want you to think about, deliberately focus on a difficult thought or feeling. I want you to notice any distressing thought that might come with that or urge or emotion that might arise. Don't push it away. Just acknowledge it. Maybe there's a strained relationship with one of your children or one of your parents, with a partner. Acknowledge it. And then with your hands on your lap, I want you to physically open your hands. If you want, you can lay down on a couch or on a bed or something if that's more comfortable. But physically, I want you to open your hands. I want those palms facing upward. And I want you to imagine that you are holding that discomfort gently. Again, not gripping onto it like a vice grip or jaws of life and not trying to get rid of it or bat it away, but gently just hold on to that thought, the awareness, the idea of it, the urge. And then I want you to practice saying to yourself, I don't have to like this feeling, but I can allow it to be here. I can make space for discomfort while still choosing how I want to respond. Okay? And if you're listening and you're like, this sounds great, I don't know if I'll remember that, just cue it up in the podcast, play it that way, or jump on over to this episode's blog, because along with all those details on mic or any of the other resources, I will also have this exercise. And then last but not least, I want you to refocus on your values. Okay, so I want you to ask yourself, while you're gently holding, making space, choosing how you want to respond, I want you to refocus on your values by asking yourself, what would I be doing right now if I weren't struggling with this thought or this feeling or this urge? See what you come up with. And that's where we can take a small step in that direction. Now, remember in the example that Mike gave with his wife, that she's a personal trainer and there are certain things with his form that could improve. But Mike was not going to be able to transform his form miraculously all at once. And for a lot of our clients, for a lot of our loved ones, for even ourselves, it might take some work. It could take a year. And so we have to have that expectation. But what is a small step we can take in that direction toward our value? For our OCD warriors, for our OCRD warriors, it's going to be tricky. But this is where we absolutely are better together, family. We have each other cheering each other on. We have therapists. We have a community of support. And so what would one small step in this direction mean? This simple practice is going to help with building that tolerance for discomfort and strengthening your ability to stay present even when difficult emotions or thoughts arise. So do me a favor, fam. Give it a try this week. I know I will. And let's just notice, let's be curious, let's be open to what, if anything, shifts. And then I will see you back here next week, and I can't wait to continue to journey together with you, fam. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better.
For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family
like Mike Tuig and me hanging with our OCD family.
That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.